On January 20th, 2017, thousands gathered in the nation's capital to protest Donald Trump's rise to power and the increase in bigotry and the hate-fueled rhetoric around the so-called United States that accompanied it. Of the many protests that happened that week, an anti-fascist, anti-capitalist march was preemptively targeted, indiscriminately attacked, and eventually kettled. After being detained on the street in winter weather for hours without access to food, water, bathrooms, or medical treatment, over 230 people were arrested by the DC Metropolitan Police Department. This group included journalists, legal observers, medics, and bystanders. 214 of those arrested were charged months later after an additional superseding indictment with 8 felonies each and a smattering of other charges, revealing a chilling new strategy of state repression. Since then, there has been over a year and a half of organizing and resistance and an outpouring of national and global support. The first trial, consisting of 6 of the J20 protesters, resulted in full acquittals, and shortly after, 129 of the cases were dismissed. But 39 people still have at minimum 6 felony and 2 misdemeanor charges, which can carry a penalty of up to 60 years in federal prison. The next round of trials begins on July 23rd, with new trials starting concurrently throughout the rest of the summer. And here are the latest updates. For a more detailed history of the case up to this point and a play-by-play of the first trial, find our first podcast series at itsgoingdown.org.
Hi, we're here bringing you trial updates from DC.
So much has happened since we last talked to you, and we'd like to tell you a little bit about it.
In this podcast, we'll give you updates, explain legal theories of liability, even though we have no law education and are not giving you legal advice, and talk about the surveillance state and the biggest conspiracy in this whole trial, the conspiracy of crime as a concept. We'll wrap up by sharing some moments of stress and moments of care from court, and share some anonymous words in solidarity with defendants. So, what happened with the last trial?
The last trial ended with a mixture of acquittals and mistrials.
Before this, I thought a mistrial referred to an entire trial, but it's also a term for any individual charges a jury hangs on.
One defendant was entirely acquitted. Another was acquitted of all charges except engaging in a riot. A third was acquitted of only one charge, assaulting a police officer. And the jury deadlocked for the fourth defendant entirely. This resulted in a series of mistrials for all the remaining charges for 3 defendants. In the next 20 days, we'll learn how the prosecution will handle those charges. A prosecutor can't recharge someone who is acquitted, but they have the option of filing another indictment after a hung jury.
Hearings on these charges will happen in mid-July.
Meanwhile, the next case we were anticipating, scheduled for June 25th, was canceled as all defendants had their charges dismissed forever. A total of 8 folks had their charges dismissed with prejudice this week.
With prejudice means forever.
The government is still trying to appeal some of the rulings that led to these dismissals, so we're not completely out of the woods yet. Are we ever? But for now, a lot of folks can rest better.
The next scheduled trial is on July 23rd, and we'll hear more about how that's proceeding 10 days earlier, on July 13th. If you can plan to come up to DC to support during the trial, please do.
If you're following the case, you've probably heard a lot about theories of liability, especially related to the conspiracy. You may have heard about Judge Marin, the pretrial judge, dismissing conspiracy charges with prejudice in pretrial hearings, and perhaps even wondered what that means and why it matters considering how many charges are remaining.
We're going to talk about why those dismissals matter so much, and to do that, we're going to explain criminal theories of liability. It should be very obvious that we are adorable, anonymous anarchists and not lawyers, and the following short story is definitely not legal advice, but this is a reminder.
There are 3 theories of liability. The first, an actual commission of the crime. The second, participation in the crime as an aider or abettor. And the third, liability under a Pinkerton theory.
Here's a short story that might make theories of liability a little clearer.
Grimes, Janelle Monáe, and George Soros are planning a conspiracy to steal the moon. Grimes steals a spaceship from Elon Musk and uses it to steal the moon.
Grimes is guilty via actual commission of the crime.
Janelle helps Grimes by providing spaceship operation manuals from a dirty computer.
Janelle is guilty under both Pinkerton and aiding and abetting.
George Soros stays home with a dog and doesn't write anyone any checks.
George Soros is guilty under Pinkerton liability only.
As Grimes is trying to steal the spaceship, it won't start. Sacco and Vanzetti don't know about the conspiracy, but are generally sympathetic to spaceship thieves, so Sacco pulls over and Vanzetti gives the spaceship a jump with their pickup truck.
Sacco and Vanzetti are guilty of aiding and abetting.
Meanwhile, Cardi B was walking by, wearing all black, chanting political slogans.
Cardi B isn't criminally liable for any of this.
The theory under which the prosecution has been trying to prosecute all defendants for all window breakings is the Pinkerton theory. If the government can't use conspiracy, they can't use Pinkerton, and their cases start to fall apart. We saw this with 18 folks having all their charges dismissed. The dismissals were a mixture of with and without prejudice. When charges are dismissed with prejudice, that means they can't be refiled. All the conspiracy claims are dismissed with prejudice. When charges are dismissed without prejudice, they can be refiled, which may feel like a cloud hanging over your head.
So next we're going to talk about the surveillance state. This trial of alleged breakers and one so-called organizer came down to identification. The tactic of police officers pointing to ambiguous video footage and telling the jury what crimes to see and what brutality to ignore. There was no hard physical evidence or witness testimony to tie defendants to the alleged crimes. The government relied on over 2,000 hours of footage scavenged from security cameras, body cams, news media, and extracted from cell phones. We live in an era when fake news predominates, and DC was a testing ground for body-worn cameras. The evidence of this case comes in the form of a highly manipulatable non-physical data, so it's no surprise that deceptive video editing was used in this case.
Next, we're going to talk about the biggest conspiracy in these cases. The concept of crime itself is a conspiracy, driven by those in the seat of power to maintain the stability of those seats. We are all criminals. Everyone commits felonies every day.
Even you?
I'm not going to answer that. Cops can pull over anyone for cause after following them for a few blocks. Often you'll hear it claimed, and we've been complicit in it, that property destruction is not a crime, or that no one is illegal. But that's denying the core violence in the system. The system makes property destruction a crime, and often categorizes it as a violent crime at that.
Is it a deep state conspiracy?
Sort of, in that the feds are definitely involved in perpetuating it, turning folks into criminals through entrapment and pressure and legal maneuvers, and increasingly relying on predictive policing. But it's not just a deep state conspiracy, it's imprinted into all of us. It's the cop in your head.
This case is indicative of the state's attempts to define a new class of violent protest criminal. To quote Jackie Wang from Carceral Capitalism, "As the war on drugs loses legitimacy, attempts to decarcerate nonviolent drug offenders have sometimes been accompanied by an increase in punitivity for quote-unquote violent convicts." Of course, the protest criminal is but a small facet of this phenomenon that impacts millions of people, the vast majority of whom are black, brown, or poor. And there has been an increase in law enforcement filing resisting arrest charges or in tandem with assault on a police officer as the only subsequent charges for the arrest. People are being incarcerated just for existing and are being arrested just for the sake of being put on file to be kept track of by the carceral surveillance state.
It's ironic that the line which got the charges dismissed for 10 defendants was Kirchhoff editing out a Project Veritas agent saying on camera,
"I talked to the Wobblies and I don't think they know anything about the upper echelon stuff."
According to Kirchhoff, this was referring to the idea that George Soros was essentially personally planning the inauguration protests. Project Veritas went directly to the FBI with their films. In court, one defense lawyer whipped out James O'Keefe's book and read directly from it, where he says they set up a meeting in Washington with the FBI and they greeted us like brothers in arms.
While waiting for the verdict, on June 5th, a press release came out from the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. stating that Jeff Sessions approved two new violent crime prosecutors for their office. Far from the Brady violation, corruption, curbing her career, Kirchhoff has gotten a promotion and two new prosecutors for the team. However, the Trump administration doesn't control the bar, and this scale of Brady violations is shocking the legal community. With this sort of uproar, it's not unreasonable to hope that Kirchhoff's license to practice law may be in jeopardy. Anyone can file a bar complaint, so tell your friends, especially defendants, to consider perhaps the only form of ethical snitching, reporting a prosecutor to the bar.
The system has no interest in justice. Well, pretrial Judge Marin forced the prosecution to drop charges for one set of defendants, another set, some of whom had nearly identical fact patterns, continued to face trial under Judge Knowles on charges that could very well see them in prison for years. One group walks free, another waits for a life-altering verdict. What kind of justice produces wildly different sets of outcomes and decisions by the court? These differences were justified with technicalities about what the trial judge could formally know and when, formal rules of a system designed by those with no stake in protecting freedom. Thus, three of the four defendants in the last trial came back with a series of deadlock charges, which Judge Knowles declared as mistrials.
We support all J20 defendants and all defendants and all criminals, even the innocent ones.
Next, we're going to talk about some moments in court. While hanging around the courthouse, we noticed a lot of unmet jail support needs for the many folks, primarily folks of color, who are forced through processing every day. While we were happy to share extra cigarettes and sandwiches, it's clear that consistent jail support is needed for true solidarity against daily ongoing state oppression.
The DC Superior Court contains very few spaces for humans to exist, and most of them are infested with law enforcement. The only place we initially found to exist and wait for the verdict was at family court. This meant that the space we were occupying was in the middle of black and brown families being torn apart. There were moments of solidarity and sharing our food with kids, but the space could feel both triggering, voyeuristic, and selfish to occupy. We were also unintentional about the space we created, and despite everyone doing their very best, conversations often traveled down paths of speculation, with everyone in the group using everyone else to process their emotions. Identifying and naming these dynamics was crucial in healing them. To mitigate the effects of being in a very stressful space, we tried moving outside and we came up with ground rules to create safety. These rules evolved from dialogue between supporters and defendants as part of a defendant-centered process, and partially in response to dynamics emerging from the entire group. They'll probably look different for other folks in other times.
The rules were 1. Don't speculate or talk about the case unless a defendant is actively processing their thoughts or feelings about it. 2. Don't ask, "How are you?" in a concerned manner.
Because it's really annoying.
Are you okay?
Just stop.
I just want to check in and make sure that you're okay. You look really tired.
Just go away.
And the third rule was no gaslighting or tone policing or managing people of color, queer, femme, gender nonconforming, and trans people. Once we became more intentional about the conversations in the space and moved to the grass outside instead of taking space in family court, we created our own protection in a very unsafe situation.
Other things that were helpful at different moments were playing games, taking space for solitude, climbing trees, taking naps, and reading zines out loud with each other. And now, some anonymous words submitted in solidarity with defendants.
There are still dozens of people on trial who need support. We can't forget them, even in our times of victory. Evidence tampering and hiding was uncovered by the hard work of hundreds of people, including lawyers and the intelligence work of DC activists. We ended up in this drama not by our opponents' incompetence, but by their capability and desire to prove weakness in civil, legal, communal, and constitutional protections. Police commanders ignored rules and regulations a decade old and engaged in sheer brutality towards the public and the protesters. The prosecution required massive quantities of state resources and energy, both created a fiction of hyperviolence to gain sympathy or instill fear in a general public far removed from radical ideas. We're playing on their territory, and we must not mistake surviving for victory. They are learning new strategies and organization. We need to do the same, lest they further the march towards a dark enlightenment.
The First Amendment does not gatekeep the right to resist. The First Amendment right to peaceable assembly has dangerous implications for any community which does not manage itself under the faulty narrative of pacifism. It is ironic that the cultural basis for peaceful assembly in America is one that is co-opted from past resistance movements which were once condemned as violent, such as the civil rights marches to anti-war resistance. The First Amendment is riddled with implicit bias as to whom it applies and protects.
Peace is a privilege. There is a whitewashed academic understanding of cultural icons who represent nonviolence, such as Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., the latter of whom once said, "Riot is the language of the unheard." The right to assemble does not apply to many people who are systemically marginalized by a constitution which only protects a few. Anyone outside the jurisdiction of the Bill of Rights cannot be made safe by a right to assemble. Undocumented people do not have the protection of the First Amendment and yet still speak and assemble, in spite of it. Asada Shakur once said, "Nobody in the world, nobody in history, has ever gotten their freedom by appealing to the moral sense of the people who were oppressing them. The rights enshrined by the First Amendment are built to manage protest. We do not need a right to tell us to take to the streets every time a cop murders another person of color. We should not be living under threat of cops murdering people in the street. Nonviolence, even in its truest form, requires confrontational force."
Dissent is criminalized already. The law is structured to marginalize and oppress the most vulnerable populations and their resistance to the dominant power structures. Resistance to authority will always be illegal and punished. Our existence itself is criminalized, and therefore we will always be in conflict with the law. We need to decriminalize dissent. It doesn't matter how you protest. If they don't like your message, they will shut you down. They claim self-defense is not a crime. Communities are experiencing very real violence right now, and they have been for a long time, but it is especially escalating under Trump and this administration. This past year has shown the inability or unwillingness of government institutions to check government power in general, but especially when it is abusing the most vulnerable people. People are dying because of government policies and the actions of law enforcement agents. Given we cannot depend upon the courts or the police to protect us, inaction equals death. The only choice that we have is to resist, to save ourselves and each other.
Resistance at all costs is justified. Nothing done by a community to respond to violence they are experiencing could be worse than the violence perpetuated by those in power. The government is colluding with the alt-right to try to jail us. This is clear political persecution, and given this level of cooperation between the state and white supremacists, sexists, and xenophobes, we cannot be expected to submit ourselves to those governing bodies nor their laws. We have a duty to resist them. One cannot trust the law given this connection.
Therefore, fuck Kirchhoff and fuck Donald Trump.
That's all the submissions we got this time around. Thanks for listening, and remember to support all defendants.
Even the innocent ones.
Much of the government's conspiracy case is oriented around criminalizing common protesting tactics like chanting, wearing similar clothing, meeting at a predetermined location for a public march, and the presence of medics and legal observers. It is clear that prosecutors continue to pursue this case in an effort to chill dissent. There is, of course, the added bonus that they would be helping protect the MPD from a lawsuit over police misconduct. Police violence and extreme charges against those who resist is nothing new. But the extent and absurdity of the prosecution's case marks a shift in the recent suppression of movements for liberation. Whatever happens in these trials will surely impact dissent across the United States, just as resistance becomes more and more necessary. So on that note, we want you to know that it's never too late to get involved. There is a constant need for support and visibility around this case, and you can find trial updates, fundraising info, and other ways to take action at defendj20resistance.org. Or you can follow at defendj20 on Instagram and Twitter, or defendj20resistance on Facebook. Stand with us as we stand against Trump and the world he seeks to maintain.